I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
409-6700. But now he is with us in our Philadelphia studio for the full hour. Juan Williams, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. And we want to tell our callers that we'll be getting to your thoughts and questions in just a bit. Give us a call. The number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, Juan Williams, this is a debate that can get real emotional real fast. And there's a sense that you have no right to criticize kind of the culture of black poverty unless you really have been there and understand it. Very hard for a white person, I think, to enter this debate. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I just think there's a false premise here, which is that smart, caring people should not participate in this debate unless they come from rank poverty. And it just so happens, so that I'll satisfy your question, although I think it's off mark, I think that there's no doubt I would qualify as a kid who grew up with a single mom in poverty. And, the big break in my life was that we got a Section 8 voucher to get into subsidized housing and get out of the rat trap we were in.
That was where?
What's in Brooklyn, New York. Mm-hmm. And, neither of my parents graduated from fifth grade. So I don't think, if that's the credential, but I think it's a totally misbegotten qualification. I think that what we have here is a situation where, as we've seen in Philadelphia over the last year with all the murders and the like, there is a sociological phenomenon taking place that requires the attention of all of us, black, white, Asian, Hispanic, to talk about what's going on in this country. And there's an intimidation factor put out by some who say they want to control this conversation, this argument, and that you as a white male shouldn't dare take part in it. And I, as a black man who might have a different point of view, oh, what kind of black guy are you? I think this is total nonsense, but unfortunately it has intimidated some.
Well, all right. So let's talk about some of the content. You know, the touchstone of your book is you talk about the explosive Bill Cosby speech, which I think he had made these remarks before, but the one that really got a lot of a national attention was on the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education. I wanted to kind of mention a couple of these parts of the speech which you quote and get your reaction to them because they're provocative. Cosby says, "Everybody knows it's important to speak English except these knuckleheads," meaning, I guess, people in the community who don't think it's important. "You can't land a plane with why you ain't. You can't be a doctor with that kind of crap coming out of your mouth. There's no Bible that has that kind of language. Where did these people get the idea that they're moving ahead on this? These people are fighting hard to be ignorant."
Well, you know what that ties into is directly the idea that you've got a 50% dropout rate out of high school in 2006, which is appalling. It's unbelievable that someone thinks that in 2006 they can make it in this world, in the United States or anywhere else, but make it. In a society where it's harder and harder to even be middle class, you know, harder to find a job, harder to hold a job, harder to pay for your health insurance, harder to pay for a house because of housing costs, harder to pay for higher education for the next generation. And that these people want to drop out of high school, well, somehow in their minds, they think they're going to be a rap star or an NBA player, the next Allen Iverson. I think at base, it's oftentimes that they don't believe that they have any chance and therefore they're not wasting their time. So what that is an indictment of the quality of the schools, the chaos in the schools. All of that is working, but so what you get is people who are involved then in this kind of language of the subculture, and they take it on as, oh yeah, that's what it really means to be black, is to talk in a way that most people, black and white, can't understand, and it becomes a self-affirming decision on their part, which is a decision to remove themselves from the American mainstream, or remove themselves from any opportunity, to not step through the doors of opportunity that have been opened in the 50 years since Brown.
Now, where the rubber meets the road here, are we talking about teachers who need to be saying in classrooms, wait, back up, don't say that way. I want to hear you say this in standard English.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, we have the same discussion, interestingly, among Hispanics, you know, where we have English, right, only, English first, all that. Should there be second language, English as a second language instruction for these young people? And the answer coming from people who speak Spanish, the parents, overwhelmingly is the kids have got to learn how to speak English, write English, if they hope to succeed in the United States. And of course, that's true. I don't know about excluding any other language. I don't know about that. But certainly, you must be proficient in English.
Another quote from the book that was provocative. Five or six different children, same woman, 8, 10 different husbands or whatever. Pretty soon you're going to have DNA cards so you can tell who you're making love to. The issue here is sort of an acceptance and even embrace of teen pregnancy and out-of-wedlock childbirth.
Yeah, I think that and it's a real sharp critique. And remember, Cosby is an entertainer, comedian. The language is so vivid, but it really is about the breakdown of the family unit, because what you see here is not only do you have out-of-wedlock birth, and we have now, I mean, it's just unbelievable, 70% of black children born in America born out of wedlock. And so what you have is kids who don't have two parents. Oftentimes the dad is absent. I think it's about a quarter of the time the child is being born to a teenager. And so the parent is not ready to be a parent, doesn't have themselves fully developed educationally, professionally, to properly nurture and direct the child. So that child then becomes a stress and a strain, both on the parent, maybe on the extended family, if the extended family is in place. And I think it's also a critique, if you will, of the kind of hypersexual attention to sexuality that's in place in so much of the hip-hop culture, on the videos and the movies. I think it's highly destructive, and it leads to that situation that Cosby was talking about.
Our guest is Juan Williams. He is a commentator for NPR and the Fox News Channel. His new book is called Enough, The Phony Leaders, Dead-End Movements, and Culture of Failure That Are Undermining Black America and What We Can Do About It. Cosby makes this speech. I mean, he is an icon of American culture and of the black community. Black leaders didn't quite know how to react. How did the word spread here, and what kind of reaction did he get?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was not there at this speech, which was given at Constitution Hall in Washington on May 17th, 2004, exactly 50 years after the Brown decision. So I heard about it sort of in reverse order. I heard of the criticism that people were saying that Bill Cosby was blaming victims, that he was a simple-minded entertainer who didn't understand the power of racism in American society, institutional racism, systemic racism, that he was maybe part of this new black bourgeois that was ashamed of poor black people and trying to distance themselves, that he was airing dirty laundry. I thought, well, you know, what is this about? So I went back and looked at the speech, much as you have been astutely reading from it so that people know exactly what he said. And I thought, boy, you know, the language is sharp. And sometimes you might even say, you know, shocking. But I got to tell you, what I heard on the tape when he spoke was that people were applauding to the point where Cosby had to ask them to shush so he could finish the speech. And when he finished, he was giving a standing ovation. Now, this is from people who are kind of the elite, who were invited to this gala in gowns and tuxedos. Now, the sort of official ranks of the civil rights leadership that came up afterwards, after he spoke, said they didn't quite know what to say or what to do, but clearly they were smiling, and there's a lot of that. But then, subsequently, there were pieces that said Cosby is maybe arming the right-wing demagogues who want to blame black people anyway for their troubles and remove all white guilt in American society. And then there were pieces, again, saying that he didn't understand the power of systemic racism. You know, a kid gets caught in poor quality schools, grows up in a bad neighborhood, lots of violence. How can you blame that young man or that young woman for their condition? And that's what Cosby was doing. Once I saw this, I thought, you know, it's important to go back and see if we can substantiate what Cosby's talking about, do some reporting, talk to experts, people who really understand this. And that was really the genesis, the point of birth for this book, Enough.
Was he speaking to opinions that you held? And I mean, did this sort of make you think, God, we've got to start shouting this message? Or was it more like it provoked thought and led you to research some things that maybe you hadn't gotten so deeply into?
Well, no, some of these things I had been on. I mean, I had, you know, obviously I had covered, you know, big city politics in Washington, D.C. under Marion Barry's leadership as mayor, and just had to shake my head. I mean, there's a guy who was, you know, videotaped smoking crack. And not only did he get off in terms of the court system, but then reelected. I mean, so you just think, hey, there's something going on here, something really bad. And we've had terrible times with crime and violence in much the way that Philadelphia is going through right now. And again, thought, you know, there's dysfunction here, and you see it all over, and the school's falling apart, and what is happening? And then covered both of Jesse Jackson's campaign, covered Al Sharpton's emergence, and you think, well, you know, there's something very off here, and yet, you know, people are reluctant to speak out. And if you do speak out, of course, then you are personally attacked and all that. And so, you know, but when Cosby dared to stand up in that environment, and Cosby, of course, is a large personality, not just in Philadelphia, but nationally, and a man who has given so much of his time and money to education, historically black colleges, more than $20 million, well known as, you know, Cliff Huxtable from The Cosby Show, positive images of black people. And yet he was undercut by some of the very people that he'd been supporting all along. And so that's what made me say, you know what, he took this risk. I'd like to see what Cosby said that was right, what he said that was wrong. Does this argument bear continuing in form of a serious book?
You know, as I listened to the debate that was provoked by Cosby's comments, and which has continued in other forums since, I mean, it seems to me that in some respects, its essence is the question of, are people in poor black communities in places like Philadelphia and urban centers today unable to get where they get because of racism? How much, you know, you have spent a good part of your career writing about the civil rights movement, and you talk about this a fair amount in the book. To what extent is racism and discrimination really responsible for the conditions that people continue to live in poor black communities?
Well, you got 25% of black America living in poverty. And I don't think there's any question that racism continues as a factor. When people are polled about it, whites often say that they think blacks are lazy, less intelligent, less patriotic. You know, they have all of these negative perceptions. So I don't think that there's any question racism is a factor. But the thing of it is, you know, when I stop and look at the level of racism in American society and how much of an impediment it is to my success, my children's success, anyone's success, you'd have to say that it's much less than it's ever been. We have a larger black middle class today. We have more people who are taking advantage of doors that have been opened. And the question is, why is it that that 25% remains locked in poverty and is not taking advantage of those new opportunities?
Our guest, Juan Williams, he's a national correspondent for NPR and the author of a new book, Enough, The Phony Leaders, Dead-End Movements, and Culture of Failure That Are Undermining Black America and What We Can Do About It. We'll talk more to Juan Williams and get to some of your phone calls, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Folkways at Gwinnett supports WHYY, a continuing care retirement community located on 109 Wooded Acres in Gwinnett, PA. Folkways has been providing community members with a full continuum of care since 1967. Guided by time-honored Quaker values, Folkways is home to over 400 residents and is committed to friendship, caring, and respect as a way of life. For more information, the number is 215-643-2200.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Ian Buruma about his new book, Murder in Amsterdam. It's about the murder of filmmaker Theo van Gogh by a young Muslim who thought van Gogh's work insulted the Prophet Muhammad. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. An internal audit of the billion-dollar federal Reading First program reveals mismanagement and conflicts of interest. Also, the U.S. versus John Lennon. Our critic reviews the new film and the case it makes. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Dave Davies in for Marty Moscoen. Our guest, Juan Williams, is national correspondent for NPR. He's also a commentator for Fox News and author of a provocative new book, Enough, The Phony Leaders, Dead-End Movements, and Culture of Failure That Are Undermining Black America. We have some lines open, and we'll be going to your calls in a few minutes. The number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Juan Williams, you write that 40 years after Martin Luther King's death, the best black talent simply don't aspire to leadership in civil rights. What kind of leaders are in this area, and what do you think of them?
Well, you know, it seems to me that if you look at who the people are who are called civil rights leaders today, it's an interesting mix. You get people like Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton who wants to be the next Jesse Jackson. And pretty much it's a straight line back to Dr. King. And, you know, Jackson said that he had literally Dr. King's blood on him in Memphis back in 68 and made a direct effort to try to say he was going to pick up the baton. And certainly he has been the key civil rights leader since then on the national scene. Sharpton is a newcomer, but clearly, again, wants to say that he is in that line with in terms of the protest, in terms of the ability to grab the camera and to complain about racism in American society. I think, though, what defines both Jackson and Sharpton is the focus on grievance and the focus on any instance of racism or police brutality or some government program that's not being fully funded. Let's stage a march or protest, etc. This is so in contradiction to the traditions of black leadership in this country going
in contradiction. Right?
In direct contradiction to people who always didn't. They focused on opportunity and they focused on strength, the strength in the black community. They focused on the idea of strong black people who were speaking to the notions of justice and equality for all and to conscience in the traditions of Dr. King. You go back to someone like a Booker T. Washington, or you go back to a Frederick Douglass. What do you see? In the case of Frederick Douglass, he's arguing with President Lincoln to allow black people to serve in the Union Army, to fight for their own freedom so that they can claim equal rights and privileges with any other citizen of the nation. You go and look at Booker T. Washington saying, let's create our own schools, let's buy land, let's build a black economy in this country. You go to people like Du Bois, and Du Bois is saying, you know what, I disagree with Washington about the fact that he doesn't agree with political agitation. I think we have to agitate, but he's exactly right about building, about creating schools, about building wealth, and we also have to focus on educating, especially that talented 10th, so that they can be leaders in our community. And Dr. King saying the strength of the civil rights movement was black people organizing, building coalitions, strategizing. He said a black community that's standing tall is a real powerful element in America, and a man can't ride your back unless it's bent, and our backs are no longer bent. And yet in this generation of leadership, it's all about, oh, well, we're victims. You know what? It's time for us to ask people for something. It's just shocking to me. I think the most pernicious part of it, Dave, is it gets into the young person's mind, seeing Jackson and Sharpton talk in this way, that really there's no hope for them. They don't have a place in America.
You also raise questions about their integrity.
Well, without a doubt. I mean, you look at someone, Jackson. I mean, Jackson, for a time, was worried about alcohol and how alcohol is pushed, you know, all the billboards in the black community for 40-ounce and beer and all different kinds of malt liquor. And he had a campaign, you know, Bud's a Dud. And then pretty soon it goes away and you find out his son has a Budweiser distributorship in Chicago. And you think, wait a minute, what's that about? Or in Sharpton's case, Sharpton will take money and stage a demonstration for one white corporation against another white corporation simply as a matter of a business tactic to somehow force them into a deal. And he's taking money and getting homeless people to march behind him. And it looks like a protest march. If you see it on TV, it looks like something, again, in line with what Dr. King did when Dr. King and others were putting their lives at risk, facing down the likes of Bull Connor. And he's using that as simply a money-making tactic. And that's why I think people would say, oh my gosh, this is some kind of race hustle. It undermines the integrity, the idealism, the power of the movement, and calls into question all that's come after it.
Now, I guess the other side of this argument is, yes, people need to be more self-reliant. Yes, we need to work on a culture that emphasizes all the wrong values. But when you start blaming people, then you distract attention from the policy battles that folks say are really important to aid in empowering black America. And I want to talk about a few of these. Let's take, for example, affirmative action in government contracts. Now, in Philadelphia, we were just talking about, you actually did a stint here as a reporter in Philadelphia in the 70s. In 1982, Philadelphia City Council passed a minority set-aside business law, which said that, if I've got the number right, it's 25% of business that city business should go to minorities, 10% for women. And it's interesting that it had a 10-year sunset provision, the idea being, let's have 10 years in which minority and women businesses are given a bit of a leg up to try and build themselves, build their capital, their competitive edge. And then after 10 years, the law will sunset and we will reexamine it. It's now 25 years later, and its advocates still believe that minority set-asides are a critical to empowering black businesses. This raises the issue of affirmative action generally. Is it helpful? What do you think about it?
Well, I don't think there's any question it's helpful. It's helpful just for the purposes of the people who first wrote the law. But the question is, how long can you get support from the body politic in this country, or even in Philadelphia? I think Philadelphia is a black majority city.
Not quite,
but close. Okay, so a city with a substantial proportion of its population that's African American. How long can you get political support for this? And as you know, in the Michigan case, Sandra Day O'Connor, the former Supreme Court justice, said she thought affirmative action at best had 25 years to go. My sense is that affirmative action is critical. This is a country where we've not only had slavery, we've had legal discrimination. People purposely, intentionally denied everything from union cards to apprenticeships to internships. And the idea that people would be given the opportunity to prove that they can do the job, that they can compete in this environment, is critical. Now, it's not the point, though, that it should be a permanent thing. I don't think anybody, obviously the people who originally wrote the bill thought 10 years. People may subsequently think, well, we can do a little longer, go a little farther. But the point is, this is running out. And even someone who's an advocate like me recognizes this and says, you know what, this is the time then to take advantage of whatever leg up opportunities, preferences are being given, because this is not an endless deal and it doesn't have that much more life from the historical perspective.
And what about the argument that the administration will use the argument that Cosby makes, that you make, to justify cuts in public housing, in public health, in all kinds of, assistance to needy families?
I don't see any evidence of that. I mean, to my mind, the argument is that when Bill Cosby speaks out, or when I write this book and people say, well, gee, look at this. People aren't taking advantage of opportunities. Look at the breakdown. Look at the problems inside the black community. I don't think it's anybody's secret. It's not a matter of airing dirty laundry. The way Cosby, again, using that vivid language of his, puts it is, your dirty laundry gets out of school at 2:30, 3 o'clock. It's walking down the street using the N-word, cursing people engaged in smoking pot and sometimes sexual behavior with each other, then violence. Everybody sees. Everybody look in the front page of the papers today. The high murder rate here in Philadelphia. People know what's going on. There's dysfunction. Something is seriously wrong, and yet there are people who want to say, "Oh no, don't talk about it. Don't say anything." And if you're white, gosh, that's not your bailiwick. Don't join in this conversation. Or the government's not going to fund some program. This is to my mind a grand diversion. It's a scheme. What's really at stake here is a moment where we have to hold up the mirror to ourselves as African Americans first and foremost, but that the community, the last line, the subtitle of this book is what we can do about it, and it's we, all Americans, black and white, rich and poor, can do about it, because it affects us all in terms of our safety on the street, in terms of the quality of education in our schools. It affects the quality of the workforce. It affects the quality of our lives as we try to build community in this country. We have lost the sense of coming together that empowered the civil rights years during, when I was writing Eyes on the Prize. The thing that most, sort of lifted my spirit was the idea of people saying, this is not just about one race. It's not like, oh, yeah, we're going to have city government that's run by the Italians, and we had it then run by the Irish, and now it's the blacks' turn. No. This is about building an America that where there's equality and justice for all, for men, for women, blacks, white, Hispanic, and that's why everybody was coming together. That spirit has now somehow been lost. It's dissipated as it's become much more just about our turn. I think that's a tremendous loss.
My guest is Juan Williams. He is national correspondent for NPR, also a commentator for Fox News, and author of a provocative new book called Enough: The Phony Leaders, Dead End Movements, and Culture of Failure That Are Undermining Black America, and What We Can Do About It. We're going to talk about what we can do about it as we get into the conversation, but we have some callers that want to get in. I want to go to Nan, who is with us from Bryn Mawr. Are you there, Nan?
Yes, I am.
All right, thanks for holding on. Go ahead.
I was just reading Beverly Tatum's book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And she contends that after the desegregation, all the black teachers who had taught in segregated schools were removed from their jobs as role models for those children, and that has a great deal to do with what's happened to our public education for black children. And since I've been seeing a program administered and run by black adults in North Philadelphia that has been very successful in training junior black student leaders, I'm wondering what you think about her idea that these children would be much better served if their teachers were people of color.
Well, I don't think there's any shortage of black teachers in where I live in Washington, D.C. or in Philadelphia. But, I mean, the question is, really a historical one about the kind of attitude and the people that were in those schools in the 50s when integration came, and oftentimes black teachers and black administrators, principals, were the ones who lost their jobs, who were pushed out as the integration took place in terms of integration into the white school system, not into the black school system.
Right.
And so that created a change. But I think that's, you know, sort of a smaller subset of an argument. There's no shortage of black teachers, as I said. I don't think that's the issue today. But what you have are people who are going off, and in the program that you cited, I think, creating separate schools that have different standards, have different requirements, where they really hold the kids to the fire in terms of coming to school, behaving in a certain way, learning in a certain way, have high expectations for those young people. That's really about educational reform. And I think that is absolutely critical because we have too many failing schools.
Okay, thanks for calling, Neil. Let's go to Bill. He's with us from the Northeast. You there, Bill?
Yes.
Go ahead.
As far as Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, I really disagree with Mr. Williams. When there are different issues that occur and people need help, I think one of the two things they think about is the NAACP, and then they think about Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, because these are people who are willing to go out there and put themselves on the front line. I guarantee you none of them think about calling Juan Williams up. You know, they think about people who are recognized, who have stood up for things, and aren't afraid to take a stand. So I appreciate and respect his, you know, what he's saying about Bill Cosby. But I disagree as far as what he's talking about Al Sharpton and also Jesse Jackson. It seems like he's just repeating what many white people say, and I disagree with that.
Well, hold on so I can respond to you.
Go right ahead.
You know, I'm distressed at this. First of all, my role is I'm a journalist. I don't hold myself up as Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton. I don't want to be Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton. The second thing is I think that what they have is the ability to get the cameras, the microphones, to attract reporters.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that what they do is that they stand up and they say, we have a reputation, we're going to hold a march. Again, they play on the legacy of Dr. King, the legacy of the Civil Rights Movement in just that way. But my question is, as a journalist, I have to hold people accountable, especially leadership. And so you say, well, what have they done that leads to a better quality of life? Have they truly addressed, let's take the crime problem, since that's at the front of everyone's mind today in Philadelphia. Have they addressed the crime problem, the violence problem, in a way that has helped us? Have they dealt with the problem of schools? Have
Nobody
they dealt
calls
with
them
the
about
problem?
Crime in their neighborhood. They call the police for that. So
no.
You are trying to hold them responsible for the police job. Don't
no.
do that.
No,
the
I'm
police
not.
Police are there for crime.
No,
don't
I don't think you're. I think you're misunderstanding
okay,
something.
Bill, I appreciate you calling. I'm going to let Juan Williams respond. Then we're going to move on. Thanks very much for calling, Bill. Yeah, go ahead, Juan.
But I think what I'm trying to say to Bill is what you have to do is you have to speak and take responsibility inside the community at some point. The police can only do so much. In Washington, D.C., where we had a crime wave, they've imposed a curfew to try to keep young people off the streets after 10 p.m. That's a Band-Aid. It's not really going to deal with the problem. The problem too often starts at home. In the speech, Dave, that you were reciting from Bill Cosby, Cosby talks about a mother crying, seeing her little boy in the orange jumpsuit given to him by the local jails, and she shows up in court. She says, oh, my God, what are you doing to my little boy? Why are you putting handcuffs on my child? And Cosby said, you know, where were you when that boy was 18, when he was 8 years old, when he got his first gun, when he was stealing Cokes out of the corner store, stealing pound cake? At some point, it becomes a matter of what's going on in the home, what's going on in the community in terms of acceptance of crime. And this is where not the police, but where someone who's a leader can stand up and try to change the attitudes, the assumptions, the givens in the community. So that say, you know what, we don't want people involved with crime. It hurts our community. It diminishes our lives when people are shooting each other over some drugs. Don't do it.
You know, you say in the book, very few black voices in the pulpit or political stage are focused on having black people take personal responsibility for the exorbitant amount of crime committed by black people against other black people. And while that may be true of Sharpton or Jesse Jackson, at least in the widely recognized sphere at which they get national headlines, I know that in Philadelphia, a number of African-American leaders, political leaders, and preachers talk about this all the time, and they go into communities and exhort people to take responsibility and to cooperate with the police, and they rail against the Stop Snitching campaign, but it seems a tough road to hoe.
And those people are to be heralded, they're to be saluted and supported. That's the real work. Those people, in my mind, are real leaders. I'm just saying what I was saying to Bill is I don't see that coming on the national level where you get all the TV cameras and the microphones as a consistent message. You know what? This is the business in this generation. This is our civil rights struggle to stop people being shot on the streets when they're 5 years old. That's why is that going on without the Sharptons and the Jacksons using their pulpit to cry?
You know, we got a lot of callers and I'm going to get some more of them, but are there, I mean, a lot of this gets down to changing individual behavior in people's, in families, getting the 14-year-old girl not to become sexually active, right. You know, getting kids not to hang around with the kids on the corner that are going to get them into trouble. Do you see any models of intervention, government programs that build families or fight teen pregnancy? Do you see a rays of hope here? I mean, just talking about it doesn't seem to – well, maybe we need more talk, but I'm not sure that's enough.
Well, I think talk is so important, Dave, and that's why I say, you know, I think there's a lot of intimidation that goes on where people are told, you can't talk about this, it's not your issue or whatever. I want to rebel against that and invite everybody into the conversation because I think lots of ideas and energy are needed on this front. We're needed in terms of how we reform schools. I mean, you have people from Bill Gates and others trying to help with new kinds of models for high schools. You have people who are philanthropists who are trying now with emphasis on the strength and power of marriage, not only in terms of building family and relationship, but even building wealth, how marriage is a platform for that. And young people need to know it and value marriage. We talk about better care in terms of parenting programs that emphasize what it means to be a parent is not just the ability biologically to have a child, but to nurture and to guide and to help someone along the path as they grow. And you don't just smack your kid and you don't use the N-word in front of your kid and you don't, I mean, you know, those are patterns that repeat generation to generation and they're dysfunctional and they lead to failure. So there are programs out there. And the thing is, do people believe that they can take advantage of these programs? Do they believe that there is opportunity out there? I don't think there's any question as opportunity. What I question is whether or not they believe it. And I think too often they take on a victim mentality that says, you know what, doesn't matter. Why try? Or if they see someone else who's trying, that person's acting white or trying to be better than somebody and they get put down.
Our guest is Juan Williams. He is national correspondent for NPR. He is also a commentator for Fox News. He's the author of 5 previous books, and his latest is a provocative one. It's called Enough: Phony Leaders, Dead-End Movements, and Culture of Failure That Are Undermining Black America. We'll be getting to some of your phone calls in just a moment. The number is 1-888-477-9499. This is Radio Times, and we'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Cardiovascular Center at the Chester County Hospital is now a cardiac surgical partner with the world-renowned Cleveland Clinic. More about this new partnership can be found online at 866-DRHEART.com or by phone at 1-866-DRHEART. In Westchester, Pennsylvania, the Cardiovascular Center is part of the health network of the Chester County Hospital. Beyond good care. Philadelphia moves forward to the next mayoral election. How will surrounding areas be affected? What issues concern the entire region? How will the future of Philadelphia help determine the future of the entire Delaware Valley? The Next Mayor, a groundbreaking multimedia project to explore the issues leading to the Philadelphia mayoral election. Your issues, your voice. Presented by WHYY, the Daily News, and the Committee of 70. To learn more, visit thenextmayor.com.
Next time on Day to Day.
Listen to Diana Krall sing, and it's easy to make comparisons to another jazz artist, Chet Baker.
They make up for their modest technical gifts with a soft, breathy, sensual sound and persona.
But can she be just as captivating as Baker on her new album?
Musician and critic David Was takes Diana Krall's new CD for a spin.
Next time on Day to Day.
And you can depend.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Dave Davies in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. Our guest is Juan Williams, national correspondent for NPR and author of a book, Enough: The Phony Leaders, Dead-End Movements, and Culture of Failure That Are Undermining Black America and What We Can Do About It. We have a full bank of calls I want to get to, Juan, but let's talk just a little bit about the influence of hip-hop. You know, I got 2 kids that are college age. They listen. You have? Are your kids into this stuff?
Oh, sure. They love. My kids are a little older now, 26, soon to be 25, and then there's a 17-year-old still at home. But yes, they all hip hop fans.
I assume your kids are, I shouldn't assume it, but I hope your kids are doing okay in life. They're not out
gangbanging.
Now, you say that hip-hop revels in the pathology of black life, degrades our women, reduces our men to murderers. With the help of corporate backers, hip-hop does its damage to vulnerable black minds, plants negative attitudes about black people in white American minds. There's some nasty stuff out there in hip-hop, you know, Snoop Doggy Dogg and a lot of other folks. Are we sure that that is harming our kid, affecting kids' behavior, or is this just entertainment?
Oh, I think it affects behavior because I think it affects, you know, the way that you see yourself. If you're a young black person, when I have three kids, and when they look at the TV for some sense of themselves as black people in America, what's the image offered up by hip-hop? I mean, it's you got to have a lot of attitude. You almost have to fulfill some kind of Mandingo, violent, oversexed image caricature of a black male. A gun. Oftentimes you have a gun. You have a lot of bling on. And then the young women, they only have a role to play if they're dressed like strippers in this image. That's what's offered up as a authentic and real black person in this world. And this is a world that's glorified not only by the gangster rappers, it's glorified by the athletes who tend to dress like they want to be a gangster rapper. You stop and you think about, where is Tupac, you know, Biggie Smalls, all these people are dead, people in jail. This is a nihilistic view of black life. It is a culture of failure. It basically says, live for the short term, live for now. If you're a young woman, get pregnant, have a baby now. If you're a man, shoot, fire, go sell drugs, do anything, because this is all for the now, and you don't have any long-term future in this country. It is a tragic view of life, and unfortunately, it's bad enough that it goes out to young white people who are the biggest consumers of this stuff, because I think that's part of their rebellion, and some of them like the music and the beat and all that. But for young black people searching for image and for self and a sense of who they are in this world, it is absolutely criminal that's the image being given to them.
It's a persuasive argument, and C. Dolores Tucker, a Philadelphian, made a national campaign, made a little bit of headway. What do you do about this people like it, if it sells?
Well, look what happened to C. Dolores Tucker. They attacked her as a censor and an old fogey, and, you know, she didn't understand. They did the same thing with Tipper Gore. They always attack the person because they know, look, Snoop Dogg that you mentioned, Snoop Dogg is now the biggest pornographer. He says, oh, this is about censorship. Hip-hop is really about the life that people are living on the streets, and might not want to hear it, but that's what's really going on. Wait a minute. So this is what it was about? He's now the biggest pornographer? You know, Snoop Dogg's Hustler videos are the biggest selling porn videos in America? That's what it was about? And now you have him, like, leading women out onto stage with leashes as if they're dogs? And then you have, like, people like Flavor Flav, you know, the Flavor of Love on TV on these cable channels, and you have talk of women defecating? And I think it's horrible. I'm amazed that you're saying that's horrible is controversial. How can it be rational that you would, if white people were doing this to black people, I imagine that there would be marches in the street.
It is appalling, but again, I mean, what can we do about it?
Well, I don't know that you can stop it. It's a free society, but it's so crass. I would hope, again, that people would speak up and not be intimidated and not be told to shut up. What really galls me is it's sometimes passed off as black culture. Are you joking me? This is the most commercialized, you know, I'll stop.
All right. But I do wonder because, you know, again, I mean, kids are going to listen to what they listen to. I mean, when I was a young teen, it was the Beatles, and some parents hated that, or the Rolling Stones. But we didn't care. We listened to it. And
sure.
I don't think you or I complaining about it is going to make kids who like, you know, Usher or 50 Cent not listen to them.
I think it's a magnitude of difference. Clearly, you're right. The older generation always thinks the younger generation's music is way off and nutty and all that. But this is something of a whole different scale.
Are there artists with a better message? Is that a way to get
it? Oh, sure. There are people who do rap who are singing about religious music. There's all kinds of good angles to it. It's just that the stuff that dominates, the stuff that unfortunately was force-fed through BET for many years, you know, BET Uncut and all that stuff, was just basically pornography. And then dressed up and glorified and because of it, it's so titillating and exciting and sold to young people as reality.
So executives in black media need to take
black
responsibility.
Media, white media, white media, Hollywood, right. All of them are making a big buck off of it, as they say, crazy bank, you know. But I just think it's having a terrible, detrimental effect on young black people, especially those who don't have a parent in the home, those who are not in good schools, those who are in communities where they can see violence. And all of a sudden, all of that is glorified and held up as, you know, being authentically black. How corrupt.
All right, let's go to some calls. Alan is with us from Center City. Are you there, Alan?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, thanks for waiting.
Go ahead. Sure. Thank you very much. First of all, I agree with what Juan Williams is saying, but I think there's another dimension here, and that is class and poverty. You mentioned 25% of the black community is poor. Even a magazine as conservative as Economist has twice in the last couple of months run articles about the separation between rich and poor, the diminishment of the middle class, and the fact that it's getting worse at an alarming rate. People at the bottom are all those kind of people with broken homes, no housing, homeless, go to the worst schools. I represent a young girl who's been nominated for lots of awards, but she's going to high school, to the worst high school in the city, because that's where she lives. We need to do something about that, because if people at the bottom act as if they think there's no opportunity, maybe because that's a realistic view for them in our society.
Okay, Alan, you know, just hang on one second, because I think there is this issue of, does the government need to, you know, Lyndon Johnson waged a war on poverty, devoted billions to the idea that with some effort we can actually lift people up and stop this sort of regenerating cycle of poverty. Do we need more money on public housing, things like that, Alan? And keep it short, please. Yeah.
Lyndon Johnson started a war on poverty, but it was cut off at the knees because of inflation and the war and so forth. I think we need some very significant additional funds from the federal government for education and for housing and for a whole range of services, medical services, mental health services, that poor people simply can't access.
Okay, thank you, Alan. And I guess, you know, one, the other side of this is a dependency argument. I mean, that the welfare system that was created was enormously expensive and ironically undermined efforts at black self-reliance.
Well, I think that, you know, the first thing to say is I think that what Cosby did is, in line with great speeches, and especially on this issue of class, that in my mind, historically, when Du Bois spoke at the start of the 20th century and spoke about the color line as the issue, you know, breaking apart legal segregation during the 20th century, I think that is akin to what Cosby has done. But I agree with the caller. What Cosby has done is say that the class issue is the struggle for the 21st century. And it's particularly so given that you have this global economic competition. And how is it that you expect the 25% of black people living in poverty to compete in a global economic framework if they don't have education, if they don't have good schools, if they, you know, something has to be done now. Otherwise, I think given the weight of class, and there's an increasing class divide in American society, it's harder to pay for the basics. If you get left behind at this juncture, it's going to really be tough to make the leap and get into the middle class. You know, we celebrate the idea of upward mobility in America. I think it's becoming less and less of a mobile society.
In this book, you challenge the notion that more money on inter-school budgets is the answer.
I don't think it's the answer, because I think if you look at per-pupil spending for many of our big city schools, it exceeds per-pupil spending in suburban areas. Now, the contrary argument would be, oh, but you know what? The kids in the big cities are poorer kids. They have more needs. You have to invest more in terms of their education. That's true, but it's reached the point where you say, wait a minute, there must be a point of diminishing returns. Why is it that you have this money and we have such consistently poor quality schools for these kids? And once they leave these schools, even with the achievement gap, which we see even in suburban schools, you see these kids do better once they leave these inner city schools. There's something wrong in these schools, and it's not simply about money.
And you see a corrupt alliance with teachers' unions.
I think that what you see is a Democratic Party, you know, dominates in terms of black politics in the country, key constituency of the unions, and then all of a sudden it's all about patronage, it's all about jobs and contracts. It's not about making education job one. One last point on this. When you talk about additional funding, you've got to go to the public ultimately, not the politicians. And right now, according to the polls, I think it's 66% of black people, 71% of whites believe that the poor are already, right now, Dave, overly dependent on the government. You get a situation
where
the majority of blacks, 66%. And you get 62% of blacks, 70% of whites, believing that individuals without regard to race have the individual power to succeed, that you can make it if you try in this country. So what you see is that people no longer believe that it's a matter of money. They believe that it's a matter of individuals who don't try or who are locked into some dysfunctional culture. It's not a result of inadequate funding by the government.
Let's go to Brad. He is waiting from Abington. You there, Brad?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was wondering, just to kind of piggyback on what we're talking about right now, is the relationship between funding in the schools and the quality of education these people receive. You know, as far as my understanding of the funding structures across urban and suburban school districts, they are not equal. And mandates that the federal government puts forward, such as No Child Left Behind, doesn't really prepare educators to be better qualified to make sure that children don't get left behind. And so the best teachers are in the suburbs. The per pupil expenditure is about $18,000 in some suburban school districts here in the Philadelphia area versus $3,000 in the city. So, you know, if you have poor teachers and you don't have the amount of funding necessary for a quality education, these children are really at a disadvantage for really what they need, which is a sense of self-esteem, self-efficacy, and empowerment.
Okay, Brad, I'm going to let Juan Williams comment. Sure. In Philadelphia, actually, we do lag behind some suburban districts in terms of spending. But he mentioned No Child Left Behind, the Bush program.
Well, I was surprised to hear him say that somehow No Child Left Behind doesn't allow for qualified teachers. In fact, many of the complaints about No Child Left Behind have to do with the idea that people, the teachers should be certified, should be properly qualified, and people are saying, especially in rural areas where they sometimes take just a smart person and have them teaching physics, they say, you know, why do we have to hold up to this standard? But it's an important standard, especially in big city schools, and the notion of failing schools, and the notion that you don't push kids who are having trouble off the books or force them to drop out because you don't want them counted in your statistics. What No Child Left Behind, and I think there's every reason to say this is an important and good program. What No Child Left Behind has done is require educators to properly measure the black kids, the Hispanic kids, and to measure their level of progress year to year and halt the social promotions and really make an effort to bring up their test scores. Rather than say there's something wrong with the test, let's see exactly what's going on with this kid and how we can get this child to improve in terms of basic skills that are going to be necessary once the child enters the job market.
The criticism is that it hasn't been adequately funded. Right?
Well, I'll leave alone the funding issue.
All right.
But in terms of a program that requires educators to educate children, I think it's absolutely the right step to take.
Let's get one more call in. Jennifer, you there from Cherry Hill?
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to say thank you, Mr. Williams. I've seen you on Fox. I think you're wonderful, and I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I personally am a 21-year-old half-black African-American female, and I grew up in Cherry Hill, which is very, you know, not very many African-American or ethnic people that I grew up with going to high school. And I went to an Ivy League school, and when I graduated, and, you know, throughout my career, my academic career, I should say, I just graduated in May. A lot of the black people that I met, like you had said, you know, say, you know, you think you're better. You think that because, you know, you're educated, you want to be a lawyer, you're white. And a lot of the things that, you know, my mother used to always, who's not black, used to always tell me, you know, has a lot to do with their self-image and who they are and how, you know, their family unit. And what I wanted to say was, I think that there's a quote, I can't remember what it's from, saying that you have to clean up at home before you go out. And I think that not only is it in our race that we need to look within ourselves, but I think within the family unit itself, don't look to Snoop Doggy Dogg and those people for an image. Have those children have, you know, mothers and fathers or just a mother as an idol or to look up to that. I think that it needs to start within the family unit.
Okay.
And I just wanted to thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
Thanks,
and amen. I think that we got to start talking about things like being a good parent, loving kids, imposing some sense of rigor at home, saying, you know what, it's time to study. You know, what you look at when you see the statistics by sociologists who've gone into areas where there is an achievement gap is that black kids watch twice as much TV, study less, oftentimes take after-school jobs so they can have the fancy sneakers and like. But if then you see the achievement gap on the test and you say, oh my gosh, why do we have this racial gap? But wait a minute, one set of people are studying more and absolutely valuing education and, in fact, celebrating those who excel while the other group is not studying as much and putting down people who excel. Who's to be surprised at the achievement gap?
You know, we have about a minute left, but you dedicate the book to the people rising above Katrina's storm in the city of New Orleans, the Gulf Coast, and across America. You've made a point that the Katrina episode has some insights for us and into the subjects that you raise.
Without a doubt, you know, the good of Katrina was that you saw that what happens is when you have strong families, including strong extended families, those people, especially those who were displaced by the flood, they were able to get out. They were able to be helped. People also benefited from corporations who said, you know what, if you can move, we're going to give you the opportunity to work here. We have jobs in other parts of the country. Please come. You saw church groups. I mean, they sent volunteers, but they also sent buses to bring people up. I know in my church in Washington, D.C., we took in some families, helped them to live for a year, put them in position. What we know from the government, Dave, is that if you don't have a child out of wedlock, if you get a high school education, if you make an effort to not marry until you're in your 20s and then not have a child until you're married, there's almost no chance you're going to live in poverty. This is the good news. These are steps that can be taken.
All right, that is Juan Williams. He is the author of a new book, Enough, The Phony Leaders, Dead-End Movements, and Culture of Failure That Are Undermining Black America and What We Can Do About It. Plenty more to talk about, but we'll have to leave it there. Juan Williams, thanks for coming in.
Dave, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Radio Times. I'm Dave Davies in for Marty Moscoane. You're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.